All right. At first, I was just wondering if there was any personal background that you felt was like essential to your story, or if you just wanted to get into the more detailed questions.
Well, yeah, I think in the fact of personal background, I was in the intelligence for almost all of the 20 years I was in the military. I was overseas most of that period of time in various assignments with mostly other countries' intelligence services. I found that when I returned to the United States that I seemed to have had a completely different viewpoint of the way the world was, having gone to the war college and being probably younger than most of the individuals who entered the war college at that time. I was very outspoken, and I had a difficult time recognizing the politicization that occurred in the services, plus the fact that I had gone overseas to both Egypt, to Yemen, and other areas in the Middle East, and had returned with a feeling that the United States was getting deeper and deeper into a quagmire, which was being orchestrated not by our own intelligence services as much as by our allies, both the British and the Mossad. I found also that there were a large number in the Middle East of individuals who were directly connected with collecting and disseminating information who were very much pro-Israeli. So, therefore, when I went back, I for whatever reasons, began to talk to individuals concerning my beliefs, which were not well taken. I then was told by my commanding general of the War College that I had been found to have a decoration, which I was wearing, which I seldom wore, a uniform, that was inconsistent with the decoration because I was supposed to have been given it by chief, was our province chief. He was a CIA as versus military person. And in the ensuing investigation, they investigated every bit of my decorations and everything. I was quite taken by the fact that I was being almost, I felt, almost an inquisition, and then told to retire early. So I had, what I had done was, I had in almost all instances done what people have asked me to do, and then to have this occur and have the individual who was responsible for giving me the decoration stating that he had written it out, and still the individual said no, that this was not a correct decoration, and went further, even sending an individual with me to my next assignment to make sure that I was going to retire. So it was sort of a situation in which I became almost neurotic about the fact that paranoid about the fact of what the occurrence was, since the individuals who were telling me this were the ones who had my records and not myself. So I feel that it was in many ways a situation where I had probably spoken in such a way as not to follow the party line. And that might have been my demise. I am not sure, because officially, again, it was that I wore a decoration that was incorrect.
Now, are you talking about your time at the Command and General Staff Fellow?
No, this was at the War College.
Oh, okay.
The Army War College in Carlisle.
Okay. Because Doug told me that while you were at the Command and General Staff College, you submitted a report that...
That was at the War College.
Oh, that was at the War College.
The report which described the various reserve generals, I sent out a survey in which I utilized the an post-World War II survey to see whether or not individuals were more towards National Socialism, and to what degree. And I sent this out, and it came to the attention of many of the generals that were in the reserves, because I had sent this to them, and in doing so, they were very unhappy with that, and the results of which were never published. But what I did see of it was that in most instances at that time, the individuals who were at that high rank also had the same predisposition, or even greater disposition, than the Germans who the original survey was made for. Mm-hmm. All I did was, you know, more or less take that template and redo it, put it in English, and send it out. Mm-hmm. So that was something which was not also looked upon with any favor. I presume because I was outside of the United States and was with many of these other groups, that I was more not as regulated, let's say, in my various processes of thinking. And I was trying to be more objective. Like when I went to Egypt, I looked upon what I found there to show that Russia really was not so wanting to stay in Egypt, but wanting to get out of Egypt. And really, in reality, the Soviets were very happy to give up to the United States the support of that country, because they found that the individuals in the country were somewhat more insidious than they felt by nature. Many Arabs were insidious, but they felt the Egyptians were about the most insidious of all the Arabs. So they were not looked upon as by the Russians as being anything really great. So that was another thing, which, because the United States was making the point that the Russians had moved out because we had been able to move in. But like I say, that's the myth is versus the reality. And the reality was that the Russians wanted to get the hell out. And in almost all instances, at that time even, probably the Russian high command had come to the conclusion that throughout the Arab world, the amounts of money they were expending were much too high for what their final results were. Likewise, we were doing this, of course, for Israel, so that Israel would have if not an ally in the Egyptians, it would have a neutral force in Egypt, so that it could look to the east, with Syria and the other countries. The Egyptian military force was kind of, and still is, I presume, split based upon a large number of the security force being part of the Brotherhood. And Egypt today many of the officers, although they will not outwardly because of political reasons, they are very strongly in favor of an Islamic state. The Lebanon, we were looking up about going into the Lebanon, and at that time there were plans being fostered to go into Lebanon. And again, I felt that was not to the advantage of the United States.
And was this during like the Nixon administration?
This was the beginning of the Reagan administration, mm-hmm. and the end of the Carter, well, the beginning of the Reagan administration and the end of the Carter administration, but it was the beginning, the first 8 months or so of the Reagan administration. Mm-hmm. I also had spoken to the, while I was at the college, the British liaison officer there, who had some fairly long discussions about U.S. involvement in Vietnam and our intelligence efforts and everything. And I was, having been with the British, opposed to his view of how England was righteous in the fact that, having seen the fact that the British treated their Irish, especially the IRA prisoners, in many ways much worse than the Americans did their Viet Cong prisoners. The British also are not as in the special relationship between the United States and Britain, which we have, just as we have a special relationship with Israel. Mm-hmm. Both allies, in many ways, use that relationship for their total advantage. Mm-hmm. At that time, and I'm not sure we do it anymore, we were much more naive, I felt, in believing that our allies were lasting allies. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I did learn from the British was there is no lasting ally. Mm-hmm.
Doug told me that you saw British businessmen doing business with the North Vietnamese.
During my assignment in the UK, not only were British businessmen, but the fact is the British government condoned the factors of bringing munitions and selling them to the North Vietnamese.
So, can we get into, your time in Vietnam now?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
So, I was wondering, what were your duties when you served at the Can Thao Air Base in 1968, and what kind of understandings did you develop, at that time?
I went over to, the first time I went over to Vietnam was, I was in charge of a special security group, mm-hmm. which was mostly a group which dealt with specifically the transmission of information in higher commands from one command to another. Mm-hmm. However, we went down and worked with the Army Security Agency with communications intelligence to a great degree. Mm-hmm. And because of not having a large number of individuals in the Mekong Delta around Can Tho, my group became more or less also a kind of an operational unit, which was used for direction finding and destruction of various Viet Cong infrastructure. Can Tho was really an advisory group more down there than it was when I was there. They did bring in, I think, a division or one division, but it stayed for a little bit of time.
U.S. or Arvin?
That was U.S. And they did have an Arvin. They had several Arvin divisions down there. I think they had two Arvin divisions down there. I should say several do. And then we had the SEALs. Mm-hmm. And then we had a small special forces detachments. And all of those worked together, and then we supplied them mm-hmm. with certain intelligence information.
So were you like running agent nets and
most of the stuff was dealing with Army Security Agency and communications intelligence, interception type of stuff.
So signals intelligence?
Right, signals intelligence. That would be more of what it was.
And then when you first arrived in Saigon, you were picked up by an Air America plane, right?
That was in the 72.
You came.
Yeah, my second tour. Mm-hmm. I was picked up by a light plane that sent me down country. I didn't realize what the Phoenix program really consisted of. We were brought in and taught at Fort Bragg. I had come from the UK. I was in the intelligence analytical area over in the UK. And when I was sent to Fort Bragg, the Phoenix program was being kind of shuffled from the Central Intelligence Agency into a quote quasi-military Central Intelligence group. So when I got there, I was sent down country, or up country, a small plane in which I arrived in Quy Nhon, province of Quy Nhon. And I became the Phoenix advisor for Quy Nhon. This was just at the beginning of the total regular military evacuating Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So as the military was evacuating, there was more and more need to build these various groups, such as the Province Reconnaissance Unit, and this is not true of all of the provinces, but I more or less had a subordinate who took over the Province Reconnaissance Unit. Mm-hmm. I had another was psychological warfare. Mm-hmm. So what I ended up with is several various organizations which the individuals who had been in them had left, and we had taken over, and we ran them, and more or less created our own, auxiliaries for because the Vietnamese were going to take it over. Mm-hmm. So, and many of these were individuals like the Nung. They were overseas Chinese. They were individuals that, first of all, didn't get along, especially with the Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. And in many instances, the South Vietnamese who were there, which we didn't recognize at the time, had already made allegiances, especially in Quy Nhon and in Binh Dinh province, mm-hmm. which had always been a kind of a hallmark of the North Vietnamese Viet Cong groups. Mm-hmm. They were already working with the National Liberation Front, mm-hmm. and they were officers of the South. Mm-hmm. So when we went in, we were working not only against the Viet Cong, but in instances they knew, not us, we didn't know, but they knew that these individuals who they were fighting against were part of their own groups. Mm-hmm. So it was like a civil war, mm-hmm. but a civil war that turned sour. I guess it would be probably like the border wars in Missouri or something, mm-hmm. I would presume, where one day a guy's on one side and the next day a guy's on the other. Mm-hmm. I also was, because of the lack of personnel, I was sent up to the various districts as a district advisor, mm-hmm. and we literally got into two or three fairly large battles against North Vietnamese regiments and Viet Cong, who were moving into the northern parts of Binh Dinh. So you had a situation where a line at Phu Cat had been created arbitrarily, and most of the north was controlled by the North Vietnamese in Binh Dinh. So as I left, Vietnam, control of Binh Dinh was just a matter of weeks that they would probably take over the whole province. Most of the officers I was with, they were all in advisory positions. And a lot of the South Vietnamese officers and, to be truthful, the soldiers themselves who had not been paid didn't have the stomach to want to really get into actual combat with their fellow Vietnamese. And that was for, they felt that the government in Saigon had already let them down to a great degree, I would presume. So, I mean, what I saw was a transition from literally a army backed by the United States to a completely almost shadow army, which was kind of falling apart internally. And that's really what occurred in Vietnam, was the army itself just was not functioning.
The U.S. Army or the
Arvin? Well, yeah, the U.S. Army had already left, the Arvin, which we tried to have take over. I think this would be a good example of what would happen in Iraq right now. You would find that if the United States moved out today, the factions, and we forget, which I think a lot of people forget, is that in all of these countries, not unlike the United States, there are factions within each one of these military organizations. And what was amazing was much of the fighting which occurred, especially in the South Vietnamese would not admit to this, but they were just as strongly advocating a destruction of Cambodia, the Mon Yards. While we were fighting the Viet Cong, the Vietnamese were fighting other elements on that in that areas. So I mean, there was truly a civil war, but the civil war was not just, it was between the Viets, the overseas Chinese, the Cambodians, Khmer Rouge, and to some degree the Mon Yards. It was like almost like the cavalry fighting the Indians, and because the Vietnamese were not really too kicked in the behind with the Mon Yards. And then they weren't on the Cambodian border. They considered the Cambodians to be inferior to the Vietnamese. And to the overseas Chinese, which most of the people who left Vietnam, everybody always thinks that the Vietnamese left Vietnam. It was mainly overseas Chinese to a great degree who were a mix of overseas Chinese and Vietnamese. But they were mostly, you know, overseas Chinese. So, and that wasn't brought into any play in our doctrine or anything. And we kind of just took a blind, you know, blindsided to that one. But that's where the real occurrences were in many ways. Plus these various factions within the Vietnamese military itself.
What kind of impressions of the CIA did you get in you know, your first few months working in
Phoenix? Well, I had worked, you know, when I was over in the UK, I had worked with the various intelligence. When we talk about the Central Intelligence Agency, Central Intelligence Agency is composed of several groups, and I mean, all it is a coordinating action group that deals with these various groups. There are staffers in the CIA who are operatives, but for the most part, a large portion of the CIA is various groups that are all over, as you may call it, the company. So, therefore, like when I was in the UK, we had certain groups that were allied with the British Intelligence Service. Although the Brits are called military intelligence, they deal a lot with the political aspects of things, too. And that's where the Central Intelligence Agency comes in. It comes in mainly, at that time it did, is dealt more with the both civilian and military, but it's easier to collect information on the military, and so anytime something's easier, people move towards the easiest situation. So that's how in reality, that's how the DIA and CIA got together, in fact, of looking more towards the military side, because they could count number of tanks, they could do all this, but they couldn't really, in many ways, analyze a lot of this stuff, and that's what I was saying about the fact that we rely heavily on our various groups overseas. So, I mean, especially the American Intelligence Service relies heavily on, like if you're in Latin America, it's going to heavily rely on Brazil. It will rely heavily on the Argentines, various Central American services which we'll derive from. At the same time, it also relies on various pseudo-groups that are associations that are in these various countries. And in fact, the major amount of information that's derived, especially in many of these areas where we do not have the ability for linguistics, will come from, quote, the ally who has mutual interest with us. So you'll find, unlike the Brits, who literally would train, I mean, we do have some Arabist. We do have some, but it is easier to find a Iranian who is probably connected with some other group in the Middle East who would deal through that, just like the Chinese do with their overseas Chinese people. The intelligence networks are usually set by countries who have large numbers of people overseas. The Indians in Africa, the Chinese in Africa, you'll find that, you know, along the border of the United States, almost every border town has a Chinese restaurant. And, you know, you wondered why, and then you kind of figured that one out after a bit, you know. This is a method that has always been utilized, is that you put diasporas, when people spread around the world, then you connect them, and they have a greater loyalty by the very nature of them being with who they are. So, I mean, you know, if you really look at the facts of overseas Chinese, you're going to find more and more overseas Chinese becoming the agents of China. At the same time, if you find in Europe, you'll find various groups of Europeans who, let's say, like Germans, if they have colonies in Hungary, then you'll find they kind of utilize some of these groups for their own. Or a Hungarian in Slovakia, then he will go into Slovakia and try to create a network for that country for, you know, intelligence services. So that's, you know, it's just a normal procedure.
So, what was, in your second tour, what was Larry Jackson, your CIA province officer in charge, like, what was your relationship
with him? Well, see, now, Larry was older ex, I presume ex-military. Again, most of the, at the province levels, these are mostly kind of like contract officers, mm-hmm. are older men who had worked in, it's like the Foreign Service, mm-hmm. where a guy, if he goes onto the African desk, mm-hmm. and he doesn't get Paris, London, or Moscow, then he's going to be shuffled down the trip. And Larry was probably one of those guys who was, in many ways, pushed down to the province level. Mm-hmm. And to be very frank, I don't know whether he was a staffer or if he was a contract type. And there was a lot of individuals who were literally ex-military officers who mm-hmm. were working for the agency too. Yeah. Like Mr. Swango, mm-hmm. who was our province, a province senior advisor. Mm-hmm. And then there were a lot of politicos who got jobs, which I didn't at the time even recognize, but they literally got them, not unlike how the FEMA director in Katrina mm-hmm. got his job through connections and everything, and then they would go over. And they were mostly, again, more politically motivated than career mm-hmm. oriented.
Mm-hmm. So then Jackson was not your typical CIA careerist then?
From my point of view, I think he was. He really was, because I think, again, people have a mistaken aspect of the Central Intelligence Agency. I think the Central Intelligence Agency has, for the most part, a cadre, not unlike what we have in the military, where you have reserves and mm-hmm. regulars. You have a cadre of very well-trained and very capable human beings. Many of them going to, from the Ivy Leagues and everything, and these guys are placed in those areas which they either feel are very necessary or that they're areas which there's a tremendous amount of dissension. And they put these guys in as people, something like El Salvador, where we found that, William Walker came down and now has reached the pinnacle of being an advisor in the National Security Agency, which, he was kind of just an operat, mm-hmm. but has risen, mm-hmm. and most of the individuals who rose to these factors, what they do is they send a guy usually out to the field, and the guy after he gets in the field and well versed in some various areas, they take him back and they put him into the analytical abilities back at Langley. But sometimes they just take people who are good analysts and put them in, and then they keep guys out in the field as their agents. Mm-hmm. Like I say, most of these individuals though work within a framework of having an individual who is very capable and knowledgeable of an area, like let's say in Croatia or in Serbia. The guy speaks the language, knows it and everything. He may even be a Serbian, but then he the case officer takes him, but he runs a net more or less. So it's not a real let's see, how can I say it? It's formulated on such that there are bureaucrats in it, and yet there are people who are the ones who really run it. Mm-hmm. It's a bunch of officers and then a bunch of sergeants, and the sergeants are really warrant officers mm-hmm. who really are the specialists mm-hmm. and who really run the thing. That's more or less, I guess, the way you could kind of do it. But again, the difference between the fiction and the myth. Tremendous amount of intelligence that was given by the The United States technologically is by far superior than all others. But when it comes to human intelligence, again, at least we didn't have, we may be getting it, I don't know anymore, but historically, we were never a nation who had that tremendous ability to take individuals, train them, and send them into these areas like the British did into India, where a guy spoke 20 different dialects. We do have some, but limited
about. Do you think, is there anything, any specific reason why you think that is, or do you think that's...
Well, I think it's because of our cultural backgrounds. We've never, Americans have never been great in the linguistics of, I mean, even the Americans who come over here who know another language, we try to push them into speaking English and not, and almost losing their own languages. We did that with the Germans, we did that with the Hungarians, the Italians, anybody, everybody had to learn English. So it's, we don't have a culture of wanting to have people who are multilingual. Where the Europeans, by the very nature of the country being so close and everything, they do. So there is a tremendous cultural aspect of that. And the American education system doesn't really create, in all honesty, if an individual is not naturally gifted with linguistics, going to any one of our language schools or to our universities gives them the ability to be able to really be able to utilize that language to the greatest degree. Now, if an individual comes over and he's a Russian, and he has, and his family had left Russia and went to, let's say, Germany or something like that, and he can speak the language, then yes, or Chinese, and they've gone to somewhere in the Middle East or something like that, then that type of person could do it. Missionaries, a lot of missionaries. I found missionaries who come from missionary families do quite well because they grow up, you have to really have an individual grow up with a language in many ways to be able to really make it. There are exceptions, but very few.
And then, do you have any stories about Jackson that you feel are like...
Well, Larry, I mean, again, the CIA at that time was, I don't want to say anything about the agency because I think we were watching the agency as it was being taken out of the system in Vietnam to a great degree, not unlike the military. So what you were seeing there were a group of people who played it kind of like playing rear guard. It was not a active operational environment. It was more status quo. And those who stayed after I left, they even became more status quo as the situation persisted. Because we were, downgrading after 72.
So what kind of dynamic did this situation create in the field where?
Well, you had like the province reconnaissance units. Province reconnaissance units were run by from a containment facility in Quy Nhon. But then as they left and the agency became fewer, then it was taken over again by the military advisory groups. And we had a young guy by the name of Rodriguez who went out with the PRU a lot. And then at one point in time, the PRU became almost like, it was not a viable source of information, nor was it a viable source of anything, because it had become so riddled with individuals who, playing both sides. So in a lot of these, psychological warfare became more or less, again, a group of individuals who were, you know, still getting some monies from the United States, but as they stopped getting monies, every time in any of these factors, once the group you were dealing with would not get paid, there was no loyalty beyond money. And that's something else one should recognize, is there's no, I mean, it's not like a religious fervor. I mean, and there's where you have this problem, is ideologically, if you can create an ideological stance for a person, they're going to be much more, over the long term, loyal and capable of carrying out the necessary aspects. But if you just give them money, once the money's turned off, they don't care anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Like the anti-Castro Cubans.
Right, exactly. Well, but the anti-Castro Cubans, that again was like the guys we were talking about earlier who believed in the Crystal City in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. The anti-Castro Cubans were mainly guys who came from the tennis courts, from the upper areas of Cuba, who literally were never warriors in the first place. They had the warriors that had been warriors had already went with Castro, because they were the ones who were the risk takers. The guys that went over with us with the anti-Castro were mostly the leftover guys who were polo players and everything, who wanted to get in on the next big deal. And so, I mean, that's unfortunately, when you get that type of group of people together, no one wants to be a leader, and no one wants to be followers. So you really don't end up with a viable ability. You have to have, even with any group organization, you have to have individuals who are dedicated to the end results of that organization.
So you're saying, like, in the PRU, there everyone kind of wanted to be their own free agent, kind of?
Yeah, they at the end, they really didn't, there was never a real strong advocacy for usually it was run by an American, and then you had various, I'd say, nuns, you had various groups of people who were in this. They were never that. They were mercenaries. Mm-hmm. And with mercenaries, it's very simple. Pay me, and I'll do it. Don't pay me, and I'm not going to do crap. And that's what it's all about. And in all honesty, with mercenaries, again, the people who become mercenaries, for the most part, and I'm not saying all of them, but for the most part, they are not a regimented group. They're anything but that. They are the guys who go out, and screw all the women, drink all the booze, do all of the good stuff. Well, unfortunately, I think, especially at the last part of Vietnam, we had a large number of these people who were kind of recruited in because they didn't want to. I think that's occurring right now in Iraq. They recruit in individuals who have nowhere else to go. They're not recruiting in dedicated individuals. Also, the fact is that not unlike Southeast Asia, the people we're right now recruiting into many of these are mercenaries from various groups. I mean, they could be from Chechnya, they could be from Kurdistan, they're all over the place. It's like the French Foreign Legion. Well, that type of person, in the end, it's very difficult to hold that type of group together, if not impossible in some ways. And that's what occurred in Vietnam, was a lot of these people were just kind of, off on their own.
So, can you share any anecdotes that, like, kind of exemplify this understanding?
I would presume that what you could look at is like the SAS which is a finely tuned organization. Mm-hmm. And in some respects, not as much, but our special forces have a camaraderie and the SEALs and the Marines, long range, there's a certain flair, our Rangers, mm-hmm. there's a certain flair to that group that they are very proud of being a member of this. You'll find with those groups that they do quite well under most circumstances. But like I say, when you start getting guys who come in who are, you know, kind of like hired guns, mm-hmm. it changes the dynamics. Now, the other thing is you never know what side some of these people are on. And that's a dynamic that's really rough, is because that psychologically kind of hurts a guy, because he never knows who he's talking to. That in the United States today, with a global commitment that we have, I think there are a lot of people who find themselves in a situation of not knowing where the national interest begins and ends, especially if you're creating a global economy. And at one point you're saying, we're going to move all of our stuff offshore, and at the same time we want you to fight for whatever is the remaining aspect of it. So I think you're having these tremendous, probably in the long term, problems that are going to occur. Mm-hmm. Because when you go over to these areas, a lot of the young men, whether they be in the CIA, whether they be in the military, whatever they are, when they do certain things, because it's not always perfect, mm-hmm. and when they do certain things that are really kind of horrendous, for a normal individual, like killing, you know, women and children or something like that, not that they're doing it particularly because they want to, but it happens as part of warfare. These people get, you know, if they can rationalize themselves that they're doing this for a greater good, they're going to be okay, let's say, emotionally and mentally. If they can't rationalize that, then you've got some problems. And I think you're going to start seeing those problems here in the United States a lot more than we have. Mm-hmm. Because the one thing about Vietnam and anywhere in Southeast Asia, because the Brits were in Malaysia, we were in Vietnam, we had groups in Thailand, Laos, Philippines. All of those areas are very fertile. Your living conditions are such that you, even at the worst of situations, you usually don't live terrible. Mm-hmm. It's a little like the poor in America, where, you know, they're better than most of the rest of the world. But when you get into a desert environment, like when I was in Egypt and in Yemen, in these areas, it's miserable. Mm-hmm. The environment itself is miserable. So the individuals themselves become hardened to the environment. And then if they have problems, like they're in contention with a ethical or moral aspect to it, they come back not too good. Mm-hmm. They have some. So I think that's the reason maybe finding a larger number of individuals who come back from Iraq who have some psychological situations on their hands. Because, and plus, having been in these Asian areas as versus the Middle East is the only area in the world where you almost have cultural shock as a Western European. Mm-hmm. If you are by nature a person of European heritage, or you have the concepts of European culture, the differences between that and the Islamic world are much greater than they are possibly from Indonesia or Korea or any of these other places. For what reason, I'm not really sure. It may be because they're both more or less monotheist religious groups with different views of who that end result is. They just, and the culture themselves are so different. I mean, you know, you'll find, especially with like the Arab males, they just have a different sense of kindredship between themselves and others, and especially their friends, than, let's say, a Westerner would. And of course, the male-female aspect is quite different too. So,
What was your relationship with your Vietnamese counterpart, the MMS major Nguyen Van Ven, like?
Well, for the most part, the Ministry for State Security was the Vietnamese. Were broken down into several elements. The military really controlled in the end. They more or less ran the Ministry for State Security. In many other parts of the world, like the KGB or something, you would found that the KGB officer, if he was of equal rank or even two or three ranks up or below that of his contemporary, he would still have a controlling factor in that. Mm-hmm. With the Vietnamese, however, it was that the MF, Ministry for State Security, he was literally confined to probably the field grades and his military contemporaries were mainly like colonels and stuff like that. That was unusual. Because, like I say, in most instances, LaGuardia or any of these other countries, your internal security groups are usually placed above, alongside, but still, you didn't screw with a person who was in the state security services. Vietnam, these individuals were looked upon as being kind of like, I forget what they were called, I think like little green mice or something like that. Mm-hmm. They were ran around these little green geeks. But they were, they were kind of created to ferret out the infrastructure, the Vietnamese communist infrastructure. Mm-hmm. But in most instances, they were not really adapted at the province levels. I don't know, up at the state, you know, at the national level possibly. But at the province levels, the individuals were fairly, what they'd do is they'd go in a village and pick up, in most instances, the old people, or people who didn't have the ability to have anything that was worthwhile, they'd pick them up. Bring them in. The Vietnamese were very, very strongly partisan towards their own people as the war drug on. They did not want to see their people being killed, especially arbitrarily. So they in many instances tried very hard to keep the American, because Americans would be coming in every year or something, and they wanted to do everything in a year. Mm-hmm. But the Vietnamese is like an old guy who'd been there for a long time. He didn't want that to occur, so he kind of regulated the system by which these people came in. There were instances where they did have interrogations and finding various Vietnamese. In many instances, it was kind of like a mafia because there were old scores to be settled. In some of these instances, it was not that this guy was a Viet Cong, and this guy wasn't. It was that this guy said something bad about the village chief, and he was out of control, and so they brought him and his daughter in, and they would interrogate him or something like that. You know, I found that the interrogation, again, for the most part, was rather worthless. You know, you can hurt a person. You can do anything you want with a person. A person will tell you what they want. You want them to, what you want to hear, so they won't be hurt.
Yeah.
It's just that simple. So you're not getting anything out of it. You know, and the confession you get, what is that worth, really? Anybody who has half a mind would say, well, you were torturing the poor bastard, or you were interrogating him. Even if you're just interrogating a person, it's still not giving you anything unless that person has the ability to divulge something which is really worthwhile. But in most organizations, they're cell organizations. They're run with 5 or 3 people. Mm-hmm. So there's no way a guy's going to, you know, if I'm in one cell and you're in another, I'm not going to know what to say to you. So, you know, all I do is tell the guy whatever you want to hear.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's the end result of that. So, you know, it's counterproductive. Plus, when you let that person go, and that person goes back and they have their fingers all tore up, or the woman has a breast off or something like that, man, that did not make the other people happy. You know, that's not a good way to. And yet, I don't know why groups have this idea that that really does something. I just haven't seen that myself personally.
So I guess on the subject of interrogation, like, what was your relationship to the PICs? And do you?
Yeah, I was in the PICs, and I would go in, and what we were, as I say, we were mostly advisory. We didn't know a lot of times what was even occurring, and we did have the PICs, and we would go in, and in all honesty, if we found something which we felt was rather inhumane or something, we would try very hard to have them, you know, cease and desist by either going up. Our channels are just by head on. I mean, there are, and there will always be in any type of police or security group, a bunch of deviants, if you want to call them that. Mm-hmm. And they are people who really get off on hurting other people, or they show their superiority by doing little things to people. And unfortunately, especially in the Vietnamese military, we forgot that there were a bunch of Vietnamese who came from, quote, I guess the best way I could show it is like you were talking about earlier about Katrina. There are those people who come from families who never suffered. Mm-hmm. So therefore, they believe by nature they're superior to everyone else. And therefore, what they do is they go in and they take individuals who either have in some way annoyed them, and they'll go after those people. And they're just normally nasty by nature. And there were one or two of those type of individuals who were in those PICs, who were Vietnamese officers. And, you know, they were quite cruel.
Mm-hmm. Is there any time you remember where you, you know, went to a superior or, you know, tried to stop some abuse?
Yeah, I mean, we when we were in the operations center there were times when they would bring in somebody, either a young man or a young woman, and you know, you could hear them doing something, and you would go to the guy and say, look, that's got to, you know, cease and desist. Now, the trouble was that there was a prison outside.
The province chief's prison?
Yeah. And that prison was not to any great degree open to anyone. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, I believe this should have been probably the responsibility of the province chiefs or whoever it was, the commanding officer. Mm-hmm. Not the Phoenix coordinator, but literally the guy who was with the province, the advisor to the province chief. Mm-hmm. At that level, there should be someone who ask to inspect some of these things. And I think that's true even today in many instances. What we have is a very strong problem in the fact that if you have dual commands, like let's say you have the CIA and you have the military, there's nowhere within the confines of the organization where an individual has the ability to tell the other individual what to do. Mm-hmm. Or if you have, you're in a country like, let's say, Iraq, you have an Iraqi, you have an American military, and you have a CIA guy. Well, there's no way in which there's one guy who, unless it's changed dramatically, who says, hey, I want this guy who's more objective go in there and see what these two guys are doing. Mm-hmm. That is almost a necessity, and when that doesn't happen, which I don't think it is happening, mm-hmm. you turn out to have a tremendous amount of malfeasance, and you have some bad situations, and it's doubly so in the Middle East because. First of all, by the nature of the people that they smell differently than us. People don't ever think about this. But when you smell differently and you look tattered and everything, a person is going to, it's almost like a predator. You'll go after that guy and hurt him. Because, if for no other reason, because he smells. And unfortunately, in many instances, what happens is because there's a cultural thing, especially you'll find a guy who, let's say, comes from the South down here, and he's a guy who's been in the military his whole life, a sergeant or something, and you put him into an interrogation place. Mm-hmm. He doesn't like the guy because he smells like fish, fish oil or something, and you know, and however sad that is, it's a factor, you know. And then he gets, and then the guy starts talking to him, and he's in this high tone voice, and it starts rattling his ears. So he doesn't like that either. And pretty soon, he has an individual who he has no reason to dislike nor do anything with. The guy hasn't told him anything, and he hates him though. Mm-hmm. And that's where you know, again, you have to have someone who is able to bring into compliance these various interrogation situations. It's not the interrogation itself. It's the fact of starting with a paradigm that all of these kids that are there, or all of these men who are there, are just by nature a bunch of nice guys. They're not. They're assholes, a lot of them. And for some other reason, if you go to a interrogation school, you'll find that besides being linguistic, a lot of these guys are have certain, you know, I personally, if a guy's going to become an interrogator, he should have a psychological test too. I mean, you don't just need linguistics. And then the other test that you need is a test of religiosity, I call it. In other words, if you're a fundamentalist Christian, or you are of Jewish descent, and you're interrogating an Arab Islamist, you shouldn't be there. That's not a good game, by the very nature that you do not like them in the first place.
And then you add just the fact that you know, this guy looks like the people who's been shooting at you, putting your life.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, all of that stuff has to do with it. But it's mainly, like I say, it's mainly you start with you grow up and you say, like, if you're in the United States today and you're growing up, every guy who kind of has is dark, has kind of a like hook nose, has kind of indented eyes, he's a terrorist. He has a beard. And then you go around and he smells like a curry or some type of spice or off kilter. Plus, he doesn't clean himself as well, you know. And then he has yellow teeth from smoking and everything. And you look at this guy and you say, man, this is just a bad news guy. I don't like him. And what do I do with guys I don't like? You know? A lot of people do that. Mm.
So, just to switch topics.
Yeah.
What can you say about Phoenix's reporting requirements and the systems like Big Mac and the Hamlet evaluation system?
All systems that evaluate based upon numerical basis and statistical basis are by their very nature worthless. Because men, by their very nature, wish to be as superior as possible. So therefore, they utilize this type of methodology to make themselves or their unit, to their superiors, and even to their peers look good. So what you end up with is not a quality, but a quantitative aspect, which in almost every instance ends up to be sheer bullshit. This is not only true in any type of military or security group, this is true almost throughout any type of dynamics. Mm-hmm. So what you have is, once you start saying to a person, I want to take this and put numbers to it, you, by that nature, create a false face to it. Because if you can't explain it verbally, because it's much more difficult, people don't realize this, but it's much more difficult for a person to give another person ideas verbally than to do it through, like if I say, I killed 300 people yesterday. Well, what does that mean to you?
Not much.
That's what I'm saying.
Things.
It flattens it. That's all it does. But if you say, I killed 300 people yesterday, all of which were non-combatants, that makes a difference.